as the militarization of the federal government that we had traditionally had, but also now the new emerging actor of the Texas state also militarizing the border. So I think migrants and border residents are being impacted by those strategies.
Let's go to the border city of Eagle Pass, Texas. That's extended a state of emergency declaration as thousands of asylum seekers have arrived in recent days. This is the Democratic mayor of Eagle Pass, Rolanda Salinas.
What's disappointing is that you have all these thousands of people just walking in without any consequence whatsoever. So the word is getting out. It's kind of a come one, come all type of approach. And you have all these people coming. There is no consequence. And I just want to say that I think that this is unacceptable. It's a shame that we don't have immigration reform and a solution to prevent situations like this.
So I want to reiterate that this mayor of Eagle Pass, Congressmember Garcia, is a Democrat, as he attacks the Biden administration and has continued to for the lack of response in the area. So you have the racist policies of the Texas Governor Abbott, where you have this actual razor saws embedded in the buoys and people dying wrapped in razor wire along the river's edge. That is just horrifying. But at the same time, Congressmember Garcia, in Chicago, you have this overall broken policy. What do you think President Biden needs to do right now? What can be done where you are? It's noisy now in the Capitol Rotunda. It may not be in a few days when the government shuts down, but what are you saying to Republican and Democratic colleagues about this?
Well, members of Congress have called on the White House to do the right thing and help get more assistance to affected areas. And this is what we were asking for in the letter to the White House, to Secretary Mayorkas. The border cities that are the frontline receivers of a lot of this migration, people in desperation seeking asylum, need more resources. Cities that are receiving and have a welcoming policy like Chicago and New York need additional resources as well. Work permits would go a long ways toward alleviating some of the fiscal strain that these cities at both in the interior, Chicago, New York, as well as border cities are experiencing right now. Additional resources, funding from FEMA for food and shelter would go a significant ways to helping alleviate the crunch that these cities and areas are experiencing. This is what I'm talking about that's being caused frictions in communities like border cities, Eagle Pass, El Paso, Chicago, and New York as well. While these cities are striving for greater equity, they're having to take money out of their budgets to receive and welcome and provide humanitarian assistance and integration to these migrants. So additional funding would help, but at the same time, enacting immigration reform is a part of that process, because the broken immigration system is being manipulated by cartels, by gangs, by other mafias throughout all of the countries where migrants are traversing, and people are being manipulated and misled into thinking that if they simply get to the border, that things are going to be great. They're going to be able to get assistance and jobs and integrated into the society. This is the type of disinformation and misinformation that's being manipulated by forces that are behind a lot of the human tragedy and trafficking that's taking place, given the current set of events and our inability in Congress to enact immigration reform.
Congressman, you mentioned cartels and their role in this, but we've had at least a couple of the Republican candidates for president, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador, who've actually voiced support for sending troops or firing missiles into Mexico, supposedly to battle these cartels. DeSantis has gone as far as to say he'd consider using drone strikes. Your response to this kind of language and how this affects the debate?
This is further Republican devolution of talking points. You know, just a few years ago, it was only Donald Trump that was saying these outrageous things. Now, it's most of the front runners or those seeking to become front runners in the Republican primary that are saying these terrible, irresponsible things. That's why I introduced an amendment in the appropriations process that would, reiterate Congress's War Powers Act and to ensure that we adhere to what the Constitution and those powers that only Congress has are adhered to. And two, I wanted to, through that amendment, return us to take a long look at our history of intervention and sanctions and the failed war on drugs, many of the factors that are contributing to migrants coming to this country in desperation. In other words, things that we've done for many decades in Central America and in South America are now coming home as part of our failed foreign policy toward those countries. That's why I introduced that amendment, because I wanted there to be a real conversation about what is responsible and what is sustainable into the future. It is ridiculous to think that we would be considering seriously launching missiles into Mexico, violating their sovereignty, and of course, ruining a relationship that is special and that should be rooted in collaboration and mutual understanding and, of course, respect with Mexico. These are the types of MAGA Republicans that are also behind wanting to shut down the government, to hold the nation hostage, to enact crazy, radical proposals like returning to building the wall, ending, doubling down on the amount of detention and cruel enforcement at the border that could result in the separation of families, which was a part of the Trump policy, and of course, continuing to dismantle the asylum system and defunding the ability to provide legal counsel to those seeking political asylum in our country.
Congressmember Garcia, you make this key point about U.S. foreign policy. While you have that Eagle Pass mayor saying people are coming here without consequence, I mean, my gosh, the grueling route that they take over many months, the number of people injured and who die, when they talk about them putting it on the migrants around without consequence, as opposed to the United States and the issue of the United States foreign policy and recognizing how it's driving people here. Your final thoughts on this immigration discussion as we move into National Hispanic Heritage Month?
So desperation is something that is driving people to come to our southern border. And let's not forget our responsibility in things that we did decades ago, a few years ago, that is producing this. The latest has been the sanctions against Venezuela, which has shattered the economy, forced people to flee to Colombia and some of the other nearby countries. And ultimately, they've decided to risk their lives, to risk everything, crossing the Darien Gap, and if, again, being subjected to all of the trials and tribulations of cartels and mafias and corrupt government officials as they traverse in their dangerous journey through all the countries in Central America and Mexico. This will not cease until we begin to work multilaterally with the sending countries, until we decide to change our past interventionist policies, as well as the sanctions that we have inflicted on many countries. This is at the root of things. We need to work with countries in Central America and in South America. There are progressive governments there that are willing to do this. Until we treat immigration at the root, at where the conditions are displacing people and forcing people to flee, we're going to continue to experience these things. These are similar to developments going on in Europe as well, where people are fleeing. When you add climate change and the degradation of conditions in these countries, they will only force more people to be displaced as they seek refuge, asylum, and greater security. So until we take a more comprehensive approach to dealing with the root causes, we're going to experience these types of crises.
Congressmember Garcia, we want to ask you to stay with us there in the Capitol Rotunda for a minute. I want to say goodbye to Fernando Garcia, head of the Border Network for Human Rights, speaking to us from El Paso. As we stay with Congressmember Garcia, we're continuing our coverage related to National Hispanic Heritage Month, which goes from September 15th to October 15th. September 15th, the date that marks the anniversary of independence for Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Mexico celebrates its Independence Day on September 16th, Chile on September 18th. Well, this past June marked the 40th anniversary of what many call the assassination of a leading Chicago labor and community activist, Rudy Lozano, who is Congressmember Garcia's friend and political mentor. Starting in the 60s, Rudy Lozano led walkouts to demand better public school conditions, more Latinx representation in the curriculum, also active with the Center for Autonomous Social Action, known as CASA, to organize migrant workers. Rudy Lozano was Midwest director of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, played a key role in building black-brown unity to elect Harold Washington as Chicago's first African-American mayor. Tragically, he was shot dead in his own home in 1983 when he was just 31 years old. So this past June, Chicago Congressmember Chuy Garcia, our guest, honored Rudy Lozano's life and legacy in a speech on the House floor.
I rise today to honor a great organizer and community activist, a leader who fought the Chicago machine and built multiracial and intergenerational coalitions, my friend, political mentor, and compadre, Rudy Lozano. A labor organizer, he fought for workers' rights. As a community activist, he fought for justice for immigrant families. Rudy brought together diverse communities to elect Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor, in 1983. Rudy knew political empowerment was vital to improving community conditions. My presence in Congress and the growing number of progressive Black, Latino, and Asian American elected officials in Chicagoland represents the enduring impact of his legacy. Let's continue his legacy by working in coalition to ensure a more inclusive politics for all. Que viva Rudy Lozano.
That was Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia talking in Congress about the legacy of Rudy Lozano. Congressman, if you could talk about your friend and your fellow activist in Chicago, his importance, the role of CASA, and why that legacy needs to be remembered.
So Rudy Lozano is a product of movements in the U.S. and certainly in Chicago. He was forged during the civil rights movement, during the movement opposing the unjust war in Vietnam, during the time when the Black Panthers were making a significant impact in the black community. Brown Berets were organizing for dignity and justice in the Southwest. Those movements were also present in Chicago through the Brown Berets and the movements to improve our schools, movements that said our immigration system is broken and we need immigration reform in Washington. People should have a pathway to citizenship. Workers need to be organized so that they can bargain at the table and improve their working conditions, earn better wages, provide for their families, be able to retire, things that are going on in our midst as we do this interview. We celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month in Chicago, commemorating and lifting up the contributions of activists like Rudy Lozano, who were responsible for movements that have empowered Latino, African American, Asian, and other discriminated communities over a 40-year span. In Chicago, the organization that Rudy helped found, he was our founding president continues to be now the oldest progressive electoral and activist-oriented political organization in Chicago. We are bringing up the next generation of leaders that we have helped elect to the Chicago City Council, countywide in Cook County, to the state legislature, both in the House and the state Senate, as well as my new colleague in Congress who joined us this year, Delia Ramirez. These are all expressions of the movement for political and empowerment, for progressive coalition building, and most importantly, for advocating and pushing for the adoption of progressive policies that bring equity and equality to all people. That is the life and the meaning of the legacy of Rudy Lozano and his contributions in Chicagoland. It is a part of why Chicago in 1983 broke a race barrier and elected the first African-American mayor, who was also a wonderful progressive. And it's also a part of the history and why Chicago has just elected another progressive mayor and one who is also African-American. And we've changed the climate in politics in Chicago. We disbanded the old political machine that was rooted in racism and sexism and corruption and replaced it with a new forward-looking, uniting progressive movement.
And I wanted to end and get your comment on, end with Bert Corona, who started CASA, the Mexican-American Labor Organization, which stood for Center for Autonomous Social Action. This is Bert Corona speaking at an anti-war rally in the early 1970s.
Thousands of Chicano youth are killed every year in this country by policemen's guns, and there hasn't been one single policeman ever prosecuted or brought to the bar of justice for having shot a Mexican kid in the back. You must understand that this is the request, and this is a demand for equality of participation, for the bringing together of black and brown and Asian and white people with the brown people in an effort to bring this war to an end. Because as Chicano say, there's a war in Southeast Asia, but there's a war against me every day here in the barrio. There's a war with welfare and with the county hospitals and with the schools and with the drug pushers and with the migra and with the exploiting bosses and with all those forces that mean the American way of life for us. And don't come back to us and tell us if you don't like it here, why don't you go back where you came from? We could say the same thing to those who tell us that. Why don't you go back to Europe? That's where you came from. Why come here and exploit us?
That was Bert Corona, the founder of CASA, talking in the early 1970s against the Vietnam War. And, of course, CASA produced many leaders that went on to play influential roles in the Latino community. Antonio Villaraigosa, the first Latino mayor of the modern era in L.A., was also a member of CASA, as was Rudy Lozano and Chuy Garcia. The importance of CASA as an organization that raised the consciousness of so many young Latinos.
Well, the speech that you just heard, the remarks of Bert Corona, are a speech that any one of us could be giving today as we stand with the United Auto Workers in their efforts to secure a better equitable contract and help make a just transition in our energy policy and as it relates to electric vehicles, et cetera. This is the legacy that many of us are heirs of, a legacy that we are seeking to create and build for the future. These are the lessons that we have shared with young people who want to make a difference, whether it's in local politics, in national politics, or international politics. The issues that we are grappling with are urgent. They require the action of people who are forward-thinking and forward-looking, and that push back against the type of extremist policies that MAGA Republicans who want to shut the government down in the next few days are trying to enact here. Immigration measures that double down on building a wall, that double down on detention, and that seek to dismantle systems of asylum that have been a part of our national pastime and what makes our country so unique. So the words of Bert Corona, Rudy Lozano remain most meaningful in our times as we grapple with climate change, as we grapple with immigration and fair migration, and as we grapple on how to make the planet more sustainable for future generations, and as we struggle for justice for everyone.
We want to thank you, Congressmember Jesus Chuy Garcia, Democrat representing Chicago, Illinois, speaking to us from the Cannon Rotunda from Congress. Who knows how long it will remain open for this week. Thanks so much for being there as we continue to observe National Hispanic Heritage Month. Next up, President Biden makes history by becoming the first sitting president to stand with striking auto workers on a picket line. Stay with us. In the Sky by Norman Greenbaum. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden made history Tuesday by becoming the first sitting president to stand with striking workers on a picket line. He joined auto workers outside a GM distribution center in Wayne County, Michigan.
He made a lot of sacrifices. He gave up a lot, and the companies were in trouble. But now they're doing incredibly well. And guess what? You should be doing incredibly well, too. It's a simple proposition. Just about being fair. Folks, stick with it, because you deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits. Let's get back what we lost, okay? Yeah. We saved them. It's about time them to step up for us. Yeah. Thank you.
There are now 18,000 auto workers on strike at 41 facilities across 21 states. UAW President Sean Fain accompanied Biden on the picket line.
We do the heavy lifting. We do the real work.
Right. Not the CEO, not the executive. Yeah.
And though we don't know it, that's what power is. We have the power. The world is of our making. The economy is of our making. This industry is of our making. And as we've shown, when we withhold our labor, we can unmake it.
Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump's heading to Detroit today instead of taking part in tonight's Republican debate. Trump is scheduled to speak to auto workers at a non-union auto parts maker. To talk more about the UAW strike, we're joined by David Dayen in Los Angeles, executive editor of the American Prospect, who recently went to a picket line in Ontario, California, where striking workers have twice had guns pulled on them by non-union truckers seeking to use a distribution center to move auto parts to dealers. David, welcome back to Democracy Now! I want you to describe that scene, but first respond to President Biden making history on the picket line of the UAW.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was historic. I mean, seeing a sitting president walking a picket line is something we've never seen before in the United States. And the contrast with Donald Trump tonight, who will be at a non-union shop, that is, he was there at the request of management, is undeniable. Unfortunately, some of the mainstream media are saying that he's talking to UAW workers. That nothing could be further from the truth. This is a non-union shop. Unfortunately, we're getting this false equivalence. But, you know, I think that the Biden administration has laid down a marker about what they believe should be a just transition for auto workers.
And David, why has it taken so long for a sitting president to actually put their actions where their mouths are in terms of striking workers? I think back at the President Obama, who so many progressives believed was an important progress for American politics, his auto task force guy, Stephen Ratner, has come out basically saying it's outrageous for Biden to take to the UAW picket line and has criticized the auto workers for making demands that are considered by Ratner to be way out of line.
Well, President Obama promised to walk picket lines when he was a candidate and then never did so as president. And Steve Ratner was the head of the auto bailout, which forced concessions on the UAW, which they took to try to save the companies in 2009. However, they're well beyond being back to health and have not received any reversal of those concessions. When I talked to workers in Ontario, they told me that they lost their cost of living adjustment. They lost even a 5-minute break that they used to get to wash up between shifts. Obviously, I think Ratner is a little embarrassed by the fact that he negotiated these concessions and they've never returned to the workers, the benefit of the workers. And so that's the mentality. And the mentality of the Obama administration and the Biden administration, as far as it relates to worker power, couldn't be more stark than with that comment that Ratner made.
And I wanted to ask you about the strategy of the United Auto Workers this time around. It's been very unusual compared to previous labor conflicts in that they haven't chosen to send all of the auto workers out on strike at the same time, but have chosen key plants or sectors of the auto industry to go out on the street. The result has been, because as you know, strikes, if they last a long time, they tend to fade in the public consciousness and in the media. But by continuing to keep the industry not knowing exactly what their next move will be, it's also kept the strike in the public eye.
Exactly. And I think when I talked to workers, they appreciated it's kept the companies off balance. It has enabled the UAW to play one company off the other. In the second round of this stand-up strike, they went out at parts distribution centers for GM and Stellantis. But they said, well, look, we're making good progress in negotiations with Ford, so we won't strike those Ford distribution centers. So it's allowed them to sort of pit the companies against one another. It's kept the companies guessing to where this problem is going to occur in terms of their logistics network, their workflow, and it has these benefits that you talk about in terms of keeping the strike in the public eye. And so until there's an agreement at the bargaining table, I expect this to continue.
David Day, and we just have a minute. I want to ask you two questions. One about the guns being drawn on workers on the picket line in Ontario, California, and the other on the close relationship between Mary Barra, who is CEO of General Motors, where President Biden chose to stand with the striking workers. She's been to the White House something like 8 times since he's become president. He's cultivated that relationship with her as she leads the EV transition that auto workers are concerned about.
Yeah. So where I went to in Ontario, it's a parts distribution center for Stellantis, and the truck drivers go into the facility to exchange goods so that
we
they get out.
We have 15 seconds.
Dealers.
Sorry, David.
You got it. Okay, so these are non-union truckers. They're the Teamsters won't cross the picket line. So what happened is that the picketers blocked the entrance to the doors. On two occasions, guns have been drawn. Fortunately, no violence. But
David Day, we're going to have to leave it there, but continue the conversation.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.